Thank you very much for coming, and I really am excited to be here and enjoy the opportunity to share my opinions with you, and that's what they are. I'm speaking to you today as a concerned taxpayer, apolitical, but as a person who, you know, had been exposed to a novel threat agent and then went home to write my will when I realized this was something new, I take emergent threats very seriously. I've been with them up close and personal. Okay. Also, I'll tell you, I've only had 2.5 hours of sleep, so I've been caught in traveler, you know, the black zone of airports. So if I seem a little shaky, it's not because I'm nervous. It's because I'm fried. Let's see. This. Okay. What I want to discuss today is something that is very germane to the whole issue of our national security. I'm going to be talking about West Nile virus or, writ large, zoonotic or emerging infectious diseases that cross species boundaries. West Nile virus was really the first time we had ever been confronted with a rapidly spreading disease that hit multiple species. The problem we faced was that in doing so, it crossed all of these many agency mission statements, jurisdictional lines, and since it moved so rapidly, it really, our system had never had to deal with anything like this before, and we were unprepared to deal with something that required a joint agency response. Now, given the fact that most of the known biological threat agents are zoonotic, and that all of the recent emerging infectious diseases have also been zoonotic, Nipah, SARS, monkeypox, you know, it's reasonable to ask, what progress have we made in 7 years? Well, in 1999, we missed West Nile because the animals that announced the arrival of the virus in the Western Hemisphere were, quote-unquote, just a bunch of crows. We missed it again in monkeypox because who cares about a bunch of pet prairie dogs? From the point of view of zoonoses, honest to gosh, very little has changed. We've spent a lot of money, but the bottom line is, anything other than agricultural species continue to be left out of the public health paradigm, and that's what's done us in repeatedly. And the bottom line is, the way we're set up, we use taxpayers as urban biosentinels. We wait for a body count in the emergency room, and that's how we know something is going on. But I'm sure that's not what anyone really wants. Most people are unaware of the fact that all of the animals that have served to give early warning are still not underneath the jurisdiction of any federal agency. Pet prairie dogs, dogs and cats, the things that sleep on your bed at night, zoo animals, local wildlife, you know, not the migratory stuff, but your sparrows, your pigeons, giant Gambian rats, who had ever even heard of them? So the bottom line is, we still have pretty glaring gaps in our biosurveillance efforts. It boils down to the fact that we continue to take an agency-based approach to zoonotic threats as opposed to an agent-based approach. And we still lack a mechanism wherein a veterinarian working with something other than a cow can pick up a phone, call someone and report an unusual event, and have confidence in the fact that the event will be pursued and that samples will be taken for diagnosis. Those who work in the public health field always seem to assume that veterinarians have the same luxury of picking up the phone and calling the local health department, and, you know, Marcy Layton or Annie Fine from New York City Department of Health will come out and investigate. There is no corollary in the veterinary world unless you're dealing with a foreign animal disease that threatens our agriculture. So we have a significant species gap, if you will, from a biodefense point of view. And when you consider how easy it would be to introduce any number of agents by simply infecting some of these other species, you're guaranteed to have a lot of lead time before anything is noticed, diagnosed, or responded to. The other thing is, not a very politically correct statement, perhaps, but it's a reality. We don't have uniform standards across species. You go to a surgeon, you know he has a certain level of training. You take your dog or a cat to a veterinarian, you know they're licensed. They, too, have a certain level of training. When you're dealing with wildlife, well, that's a big question mark. And that's, I think, one of our most critical weaknesses and one of our largest vulnerabilities. So that's what makes me nuts when I see all the emphasis seems to be placed on doing things overseas. You know, let's look at Africa, let's look at Asia. World Health is saying that in many places of the world, you know, zoonotic surveillance systems are dangerously deficient. Well, I'm here to tell you, we are still a third world nation when it comes to our ability to detect zoonotic threats across the spectrum of the animal kingdom. And I would very much like to see some attention put to the deficits that we still face after 7 years and after millions of dollars having been spent. The fact is, I think this emphasis on the international work gives us a false sense of security. There's nothing saying H5N1 is going to come in with a migratory bird. It could be smuggled in tomorrow. We all know that. Come on. So, but it's sort of like, well, you know, it just, we can sleep well at night if we think it's still over there. The fact is, none of us know who or what might serve as early warning for the next emerging infectious disease or biological threat agent. It's not going to be anything known. It's not going to be something normal. And chances are it won't be anything that is under any of our surveillance systems. So I'm going to ask a few questions today, and I'd like to use West Nile virus as a model and follow the timeline along and at certain points ask questions. Maybe you guys can answer some of these things, but if nothing else, maybe you can ask some other people about it. What is the point of biosurveillance? Why are we spending all this money? Well, ideally, if it's a zoonotic threat, best case scenario, you find it in the animal reservoir or the animal sentinels before you have dead people. Ideal. You know, we'd like to catch it at the far left of the epidemiologic curve. Best case scenario. Unfortunately, with West Nile virus, that was not the case. At least 2.5 months elapsed between the first deaths of the birds and then the human deaths. That's an awfully long lag time. Why? Well, there are several issues. Logically, if we were to approach zoonoses with that best-case scenario in mind, it would imply that the three circles of the Venn diagram are equal, that they have the same capabilities, the same funding, the same missions for real-time diagnosis of emerging threats. That is not the case. The reality, even today, and one only has to look at the budget and see what the budget is for Health and Human Services versus USDA versus Department of Interior. As structured, we're always going to find it in people first because that's where all the money is and that's where all the effort is put. The other thing is the largest animal agency is the United States Department of Agriculture. The mission of the USDA is protecting agriculture, not necessarily looking for tularemia or worrying about, you know, leptospirosis in rats. That's not their mission statement. And the real problem we face is, if I could have made this little thing just a little pinpoint, that would tell you how much money has actually gone into all the animals that have been proven sentinels for early events, or early warning for zoonotic events. So the bottom line is, especially if we're talking about target cities, you know, large populations, you know, what animals are going to be in proximity to those citizens? Are we looking at those species? Do we have the diagnostic tests we need? Do we have any means of surveillance, communication? Big questions. We also don't look for anything new. We look for programmed diseases. We look for the known diseases. We don't even ask people to report anything unusual. I have a suggestion to make at the end. So from where I stand, as the practitioner who came, you know, smack up to the problem with submitting samples for something that seemed to be brand new and that fell between agency jurisdictions, I don't really see much change or much progress. The National Animal Health Lab Network, funded by the USDA, therefore, the emphasis is on recognition of foreign animal diseases. H5N1 is considered a foreign animal disease, but would plague be? Don't know. Probably not, because it doesn't kill cows. The APHIS Wildlife Services has been running around training people to do necropsies, postmortems on animals. But their mission is really looking for problems in wildlife as it impacts on agricultural species. Not looking at the wildlife themselves, really, inherently for their benefit. Federal and state wildlife agencies. National Wildlife Health Center does do a lot of diagnostics, but at the state level, maybe there are some questions. I would suggest that this is perhaps something that the GAO should look into. It would be interesting to know, you know, what the wherewithal of at the state level, you know, each Department of Environmental Conservation, you know, what they can actually do, because response and recognition is at the local level. So, what, you know, how strong are we? Bottom line is, you know, if you're talking about biopreparedness, as structured, we are in a pretty precarious situation because the wildlife and the non-agricultural species or communities are so ignored that, you know, we're pretty precarious. One of the first lectures I gave was at Fort Detrick back in 2000, and I said then, and I'll say it again, you know, if I were a terrorist, wildlife, that's the way to go, man. You know, easy as pie. And it's been 7 years. So the bottom line is, we do not take a species-neutral approach to biosurveillance. George Orwell had it right. Some animals, all animals are created equal, but some are a whole lot more equal than others in terms of emphasis and funding. That didn't do us justice in September 99. Crows started dying in the beginning of June. And for all the money that we spent on syndromic surveillance, I will point out that we knew that something was going on for 2.5 months. Why didn't we have a diagnosis? Two things. Not only the lack of funding, but also the cultural difference between agencies and between species. We have a triple standard. We have one for humans. We have one for animals that have either an economic importance or an owner attached to them. And then there's that last standard for the free-ranging wildlife that's really nobody's problem, but it's everybody's problem. The other thing is there's the ability of wildlife agencies to detect rapidly occurring events is very low. They are inherently insensitive to emerging events. And having done graduate work in wildlife biology before I went to vet school, I know what kind of training I received. And it was not in real-time diagnosis of a sick crow. You know, taking, you know, a whole bunch of dead birds, well, that's part of Mother Nature, that's part of the whole cycle. They deal with populations. The emphasis is not on knowing what killed an individual animal. That becomes a problem when we are looking for index cases, pushing that curve to the far left. So culturally, that's a difference. The other thing is, if you go on the web and if you do a search for what is a definition of a wildlife biologist, the person that might be working in your state wildlife lab, Well, they do all sorts of things, looking at habitat. And remember, you know, Department of Interior, their mandate really is stewardship for wildlife and land, not diagnostics. And from the Bureau of Labor, really the least important factor for hiring is the ability to do diagnostics. So we can't criticize them for that. It's just not what they do. Milt Friend was head of the National Wildlife Health Center, and when he gave a briefing in 2003, he was attempting to do a survey at the state level to find out exactly what people did. Did they have serum banks? Did they bank tissues? Did they do necropsies? Did they do any diagnostics on the samples they were handling, bacteriology, virology? He wasn't able to get many answers. And it's probably not easy to drill down to that level, but it's, I think, a very important question to be asking. The other thing is, so basically, really, we're talking about a lack of uniform standards. In the case of West Nile virus, the individual who had misdiagnosed 400 crows over a 2.5-month period was not required to have any training in pathology, so he didn't have any. I'll leave that with you. And that's your front line of defense. So perhaps we need to maybe strengthen those or come up with the real-time diagnostics that will overcome those differences and link those labs, the wildlife stuff, to bona fide veterinary diagnostic labs. Difference. The crows started dropping dead on the grounds of the zoo. Completely different approach because I was dealing with endangered species that had value, at least to us, working in the conservation community. And also, because it was such a frontier of veterinary medicine, so little is known about these animals, on a day-to-day basis, I was forced to look for the unknown. We did pathogen discovery on a daily basis. Finding new viruses was no big deal. You would trip over them. And the emphasis was always on real-time diagnosis because all zoos are in nice urban, you know, nice metropolitan parks with rats and mice and raccoons and skunks. And all of those animals can introduce diseases to your captive collection. So we always were sure to survey those species to see what they might be bringing in. So the other thing we did, and this is also something perhaps pretty unique at a time when very few autopsies are being done in the United States. Accredited zoos have a 100% necropsy autopsy policy. You have to do that. That's a great way to find new things, is to open them up and see why they died. Our facility had the wherewithal to be able to do histopathology, all the diagnostics, and the other thing, though, that is universal to zoos, because we're part of a conservation effort, anyone working in a zoo is committed to the long-term effort, and that means taking the extra time and effort to bank serum samples, bank tissue samples, because although our collection may be small, we think in terms of the larger world collection and the individual species that we're trying to learn about. So I had tissue banks that went back 30 years, you know, medical records that went back 100 years, and I was able to access all of that like that. That was very important. So, an emerging threat. What did we need? Well, we needed the frozen tissues that I had in my ultra-cold freezer. That's where the isolates came from. That's where the identification came from the brain of a flamingo and that of a snowy owl. Serum banks allowed us to establish when the virus first showed up, at least in our collection, because we had bank samples on elephants going way back, and they were on, you know, serially sampled individual animals, and we were able to show that they seroconverted in mid-August 1999. No one else had those serum banks. No one else could do that work. And but the thing is, all of the things I'm describing, the funny thing is, came from the private sector because we were motivated to collect them. That's something that can be capitalized upon and leveraged by public health in a mutually beneficial partnership. I am curious, though, after 7 years, why I'm still not hearing anyone talk about national archives. Step 3. Mid-August. I'm working on the zoo birds, but I have no way of knowing that Debbie Asness at the hotel hospital in Queens has contacted the New York City Department of Health because she's seeing an unusual cluster of encephalitis cases in her patients. The patients happen to be in the same locale as where the birds were dying. But I had no way of knowing that. My concern is, with all the money that's been put into biosurveillance and creating databases, a lot of it seems to be way up here on Mount Olympus. I haven't seen too much that's really at the level of the practitioner. It's the practitioner who's going to say, something unusual, and then call the local health department, the state department, and the feds. The other thing is, it all seems to be, from a veterinary point of view, my perspective is that everybody wants stuff from the veterinary community. I don't hear anybody talking about letting us see public health data. And I'll tell you, when New York City announced that they had an unusual cluster of encephalitis that was St. Louis encephalitis on the weekend of Labor Day, the minute I heard that, I was like, aha! Encephalitic people, encephalitic birds, and obviously I had to go through, a sequence of deduction and rule out other things, but I certainly, that red flag went up, and I was like, I wonder if there could be a link. Had I had any way of knowing that prior to that, we would have gained another 2 weeks. The only thing I'm aware of that allows physicians, veterinarians, coroners, nurses, emergency room folks, basically everybody across the board, is a database that allows people, a software that allows people to see syndromic data. It's stripped of identifiers, so you have no issues with confidentiality, but I would have known, had I been using this, that someone in New York City was seeing an unusual cluster. And that would have helped me make that intuitive leap all the sooner. Unfortunately, this is only being used in Texas so far. Unless someone can come up with something better, I'd like to know why we're not doing trials and comparing this with whatever else, someone else has to offer. Because by all accounts, it works very well in Texas. Okay, we finally get a diagnosis. To get to that point, you need to know that after 3 weeks of being rebuffed by the federal agency that actually had responsibility for testing the samples, but at that time it fell through their mission statement cracks. I had called the Army. How did I get my samples tested at Fort Detrick? The veterinary pathologist's wife had been an extern of mine. I had been at their wedding, and that's how I got my samples into Fort Detrick. Hey, it worked, but that's not really a mechanism, is it? It's not really a system. How many other people could claim to be able to do that? And once the diagnosis was made, there were two major issues that reared their head and will with all future, zoonotic events. Public health has a tradition of maintaining confidentiality for the source of human data. But when we suggested we might want to apply that same criteria to animal data, because it was coming from a private institution, we didn't get very far. And with a single press release, the private institution lost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And no one was interested in talking about indemnification. Now, you need to recognize, if you want to work with veterinarians that handle dogs and cats, veterinarians working in private institutions with exotic species, the bottom line is you can't put them out of business if you want them to be part of your surveillance efforts. And the fact is, the USDA has always maintained confidentiality for the source of samples from farms by using aggregate data. They keep pulling back until it's such a large group, area of geography that you can't identify where those samples came from in terms of an individual farm. They do that again because if you want surveillance, you have to deal with that reality. And we haven't done that for non-agricultural species. However, lessons to be learned. New York City Department of Health had already dealt with these issues with us for 2 summers by the time the events of September 11 took place. They were very worried about what might have been in the dust roaring up the avenues. And although the public didn't quite pick up on it, they were looking for any early changes in the animal populations, small body size, higher metabolic rates, you know, whatever it is, it'll probably hit them first. Hopefully before children, if it's got to happen. But they then took the step of amending their health code law. And they, as far as I know, this is the only jurisdiction that has done this. But they immediately required all veterinarians, anyone handling animals, to report any unusual events. So not a diagnosis, just anything unusual. And a cluster was now defined as three cases. So they wanted a very sensitive reporting system. The flip side is it did come with a guarantee of confidentiality. So an outbreak of suspected or disease or unknown etiology, any unusual manifestation had to be reported immediately by phone and confirmed within 24 hours after diagnosis. Given that we still lack a national reportable disease that is inclusive of unusual events, those of you who work in the policy arena, couldn't the Governors Association simply say this is what we're going to do in our states? Why is it that only New York City has taken this step? They certainly know what they're talking about, having dealt with West Nile, with anthrax. They've been through it all. They did it for a good reason. And it's certainly something that I think other health jurisdictions should emulate. And here you go. Here's the confidentiality. So it can be done. It was just a little outside of the box, but it does work. And they do get reports every day from veterinarians in New York City. So they've got their finger on the button. They know what's out there. If it doesn't work out, if we do have to, scrub confidentiality, another reality that no one wants to talk about, but ultimately that's where we're going to end up, is the issue of indemnification. If you do end up putting, some private business out of business, well, they have a right to say, well, if you're going to pay the farmer when you kill his cattle for whatever disease, then I have a right to be reimbursed for my losses if I've done a public service. Just makes sense. It's hard to apply, the logic to agricultural species and not to everything else. Not a popular stand, but I think that's, I'm pretty practical. All right, number two, what happened? The weird thing is, as soon as we had the diagnosis, now the USDA did a spectacular job of helping us get to there, that diagnosis, but once we knew it was West Nile-like, they defaulted back to their mission statement and had to deal with the horses. The CDC was still not interested in zoobirds, and so although we had been pivotal in the recognition of this event, on September 24th, that was it. No one would test our stuff. I'm like, I don't get it. So there is a downside from approaching zoonotic events strictly from a public health point of view. Downside for us as people, it's I'll show you what the myopia results in. Now, for example, although no one else would test our samples, working with Fort Detrick, we knew we could develop an immunostain that could show us where the virus was, what tissues were affected. Now, remember, everybody was running around, picking up birds, and they wanted to test them. I'm like, what are you testing? Your surveillance system is only as good as your case definition, and we don't have one. So we launched a major study, and to define which tissues might be best for submission, because my birds, some of them had large spleens, a lot of them had myocarditis, many of them had no gross lesions at all, or obvious encephalitis. So what do? Everything brown is the virus. And the unique thing about this virus was that unlike the traditional West Nile virus, described in the textbooks, that traditionally hit the brain, West Nile 99, New York City 99, hit every tissue with varying levels. The bottom line was, at that time, health departments were only going to test one tissue. That's what they were telling people to collect. If that's the case, you better be certain it's the correct tissue. And based on our studies, we recommended that kidneys be collected and tested, because those were always positive. But best case would be to have multiple tissues, to pool them, and that would increase the chance that you would not have a false negative. So you can see how the animal studies informed public health surveillance. And in fact, New York State Department of Health revised its tissue submission protocol by the second summer. What else did we learn from the animals? Well, back when everybody was saying it was just crows, we had already shown that it was in a huge, the species breadth was mind-boggling. Back when everyone was saying it was only the bird-feeding Culex pipiens mosquito, the fact that the zoo had mammals that were neurologic, rhinoceroses and elephants and snow leopards, suggested that another mosquito vector might be involved, a mammalian feeding mosquito. And if you're spraying, you need to know what vector you're dealing with, because they all have very different behaviors, and that would indicate, or that would dictate, when you would or would not spray to abate that species. The fact that we saw so much virus in these animals raised very high concern about the level of biosafety that was required for this. We knew it was a BL3 pathogen, but remember, we had all these people running around collecting birds. And as a veterinarian, I knew, really, the first person to handle a West Nile crow was a poodle practitioner in Queens. I don't think he was really up on the latest in biocontainment, honestly. And I know that the kids in the back of the hospital cleaning the cages were high school kids. Come on. What are they going to know about BL3 containment? Nothing. I was very concerned. And based on what we saw in the animal studies, the fact that we were seeing so many raptors, we did work with a lot of wildlife rehabilitators, because like the zoos, no one would test their birds either. So I had many hawks, owls, eagles. I was like, gosh, we're seeing a lot of carnivorous birds. What do those birds do? They eat little flailing around neurologic passerine birds. Could this be oral? The fact that it wiped out the intestines in my birds, and that was confirmed by the staining, suggested that at least this West Nile virus was being shed by something other than a mosquito route of transmission. Very important, because all of a sudden, if birds can infect one another, you can have West Nile activity in the absence of mosquitoes. The fact that I was seeing it in ovarian and testicular tissue suggested that vertical transmission might be taking place as well as horizontal. So there were many things that we felt needed to be looked at. Well, as I said, people always assume, the assumption is, here's a ProMed thing. I'm hoping that these wildlife biologists are running some tests. Wildlife, rehabilitators don't have any money. They can't run diagnostics. Are you crazy? It's like stray cats. Give them money or give them the high throughput diagnostics, you can get that data. So in the excitement and in the craziness of dealing with this, really horrible event, those veterinary findings were by and large dismissed. So it fell to the private sector to do the experimental transmission trials that actually indicated that bird-to-bird transmission was taking place. We sent money to the National Wildlife Health Center because they had no money to do the studies. That's a problem. So in future zoonotic disease outbreaks, as a diagnostician and knowing how much the animal studies informed what we now know about people, a very realistic question or a very serious question, especially if a public health agency is going to be in charge and have jurisdiction over all zoonoses, I'd be interested in knowing what mechanism that will be in place to ensure that the veterinary data is used and advises the public health response. It took a few years, but everything we told public health in September 99 was subsequently proven to be true in people. I hope it doesn't take that long the next go-round, because those studies can and should have been done in September 99. The turning point came in the West Nile Planning Meeting of 2001. By that time, New York State Department of Health had had the time to evaluate two summers of data, and they came to the conclusion, the disturbing conclusion, that none of the traditional means of surveillance had been predictive of human risk. There were headlines, you know, no risk of West Nile virus this summer. The next day, three positive crows. And someone in ProMed said, it looks like chickens, that people are serving as sentinels for chickens, because people were positive before any of the sentinel chickens seroconverted. So everything that we had used for traditional surveillance simply did not work with this novel threat. I approached the CDC. And I think it's pretty common knowledge we weren't best buddies after the events of West Nile and the 2 years that it followed. However, as a scientist and as a citizen, I knew that, that's territorial display behavior. We've got more important things to worry about right now. We can beat each other up in the backyard. But, for now, maybe we need to just put that behind us. And, I approached the fellow and I said, I give you credit for being a decent scientist and human being, and I know you're trying to do the right thing, and so am I. So can we just sit down and have lunch? And I'll tell you, with everything that I've seen over the past 7 years, I cling to the hope that even people that are that polarized can, when push comes to shove, come together and do the right thing. We had lunch, and at that lunch, we had wildlife people and veterinarians sitting down with the public health community, really for the first time. And we were exploring a new means of doing surveillance. Something out of the box, but pretty practical. I thought it would work. I knew that zoos were excellent urban biosentinels for all the things I've described, because of our interests, because of our expertise, because of our habit of collecting all the stuff that's needed for surveillance. And I said, all you need to do is agree to test our samples. They really are built-in, long-term epidemiological monitoring stations. They're the closest thing we have to the Soviet anti-plague system today. So at that lunch, Dwayne Gubler agreed to fund a 2-day workshop. And again, this was another historic workshop. We had the medical state and territorial epidemiologists, the National Association of State, public health vets, USDA, CDC, Department of Interior, Fish and Wildlife, USGS, and the private sector. And we said, well, there are really two things to this. If we want this to work, if you want to enhance surveillance for West Nile virus, we need to be able to submit samples for testing. We'll send it to a bona fide veterinary diagnostic lab, Cornell, and we will sit down with CDC diagnosticians and hammer out what tests will be acceptable to public health so those results can go into ArboNet. The other thing was, we agreed that if zoos got free testing, the quid pro quo is they had to agree and be able to substantiate that they were reporting those results to their local health department. From there, it would go to the state health department, and from there up to ArboNet. But for that to happen, this was the other thing, what we needed from public health was confidentiality. And although it had never been done before, Dwayne said, well, you're right. We really don't have to say it's a flamingo at the Bronx Zoo. We can just say it's a captive bird, and it really is on a need-to-know basis because public health just needs to know where it is so we can spray. So they actually altered ArboNet and made it captive bird. So there are ways to maintain confidentiality but still get public health the data they need to respond. Worked very well. And this is the first effort I'm aware of that actually extends confidentiality to this non-agricultural sector. So really, the success of the network was in its simplicity. It was mutually beneficial to all parties. All the CDC had to do was pay for the cost of diagnostic testing, and that was a whopping $300,000 over a four-year period. For that, public health received data on a regular basis, and at no cost to them, they leveraged all the manpower, all the expertise, all the day-to-day capacity in the zoo community that would not have been available in the local health department. So it just sort of made sense. I knew that West Nile was a turning point in history, that it would bring the zoo community to the table, because let's be honest, a lot of zoos were pretty phobic about dealing with public health. They were scared, rightly so, given what happened. But I also knew that the fact that public health wanted us to help them would give us the leverage to get what we needed as a community, and that was the confidentiality. It worked very well. No one made a dime on this. Every penny went just to cover the cost of the diagnostic testing. That's it. We got private funding to create a database because at that time, and even now, veterinary diagnostic lab databases were used primarily for billing. They did not have all the data fields we needed or would want in order to do epidemiological studies. You can't go back and put the data in if you never collected it in the first place. And those databases simply did not exist. So, working with someone from the biodefense community, we created a database that had the fields that allowed us to collect the information we wanted, and, perhaps most important of all, at a time when it's still very difficult to see data across state lines for all the jurisdictional and, you know, economic issues, with that central database, with the real-time diagnostic results, I could log in and I could see what was going on across the geographic breadth of the United States every 24 hours. I don't think anyone else can do that even today. The key is access to diagnostics. The database is really almost secondary. You know, that's your buy-in. That's how you get people to continue to participate over a long period of time. But the key is getting those species access to diagnostics. That is your real-time surveillance. Because, you know, I'll tell you what, no one's going to do anything until you actually get a diagnosis. Trust me, I know politicians, and they're not doing anything on an iffy. So, the other thing is, the work we did leveraged the work that was being done by the National Animal Health Lab Network. It complemented it, because our emphasis was on zoonoses. And the fact that we were linking the private sector zoo community to a bona fide veterinary diagnostic lab guaranteed the quality of the data that was coming out of that lab. We wanted to expand this network 3 years ago. We asked for funding from every agency I could think of, because if you look at the map of Mexico, the majority of their zoos are actually along our border. We work very closely. You know, every country has a major zoological association. It's a small group. We know each other. We wanted to be able to do the same thing there. Also spoke to the Canadians. Could have done it there. But we couldn't get the money. In subsequent years, and this network was up and running for 4 years. It was very successful. It worked. And as I said, it was the cheapest game in town. We had follow-up meetings wherein we discussed using it as a template to expand to other zoonoses, because no one else was looking at that, and hopefully to create regional centers that would be sites where these non-agricultural species could be sent for testing. We had a meeting in last January, and we're in discussions with the USDA because they are now using this network as a template for H5N1 influenza surveillance, and we are hoping that we will get funding to offset the cost of diagnostic testing of zoo samples. What we have been able to do is recruit two additional veterinary diagnostic labs. California, and University of Minnesota. So in a way, we've got the seeds of regional centers for zoonotic threats. And it would, at a time when we still can't message between the National Animal Health Lab network labs, it might be nice to at least get these three labs to be able to message to the central database. And then we could do the same thing we had done with West Nile. You'd be able to see that stuff real time. So forget that they're zoos. Just think of them as samples that go to excellent labs with standardized testing, standardized submission, standardized reporting, and a database that allows you to do epidemiologic modeling. Not a bad little system. And when you consider that zoos, these are the flyways for H5N1 influenza, these are the number of zoos along these flyways, and these are the labs that will be doing the testing, and we already have a database that can be expanded and built upon. The advantage of working with non-agricultural species is that we can provide the baseline data that we still lack. With all the emphasis on syndromic surveillance, you know, the bottom line is if you want to be able to detect a blip above normal, you have to know what normal is to begin with. We don't have that information because we've never bothered to get it for wildlife. In fact, we throw out baseline data every day. The other thing zoos work with routinely are confiscated animals that get seized by Fish and Wildlife. They've got to go somewhere before the court hearing. They invariably end up at a zoo where they're held, and we try to keep them alive. But no one's paying us to do diagnostics on those animals. But wouldn't that be a wonderful opportunity to see what might be coming across our borders? And the fact that we routinely work with wildlife rehabilitators and provide clinical care for the animals, the birds that they're taking care of, we've actually created a working agreement with a National Wildlife Rehabilitators Association that is already trying to do syndromic surveillance. We would like to be able to give them the diagnostic portion of that equation. So then you've already tapped into two different populations: zoo animals and wildlife rehabilitators, all of which have interest in individual animals, very sensitive. And I need to make the point that with all the money that's been spent on data mining, for some reason people simply do not grasp that the data you want does not exist. We don't have data on pet prairie dogs. There is no database to mine. If you want it, make the diagnostics available, and then you can do your data mining. This can be done. What I was struck by in 99 was that we had so much capacity in the United States, but so much stovepiping and such a lack of understanding across these different cultures that we weren't leveraging all the work that was being done. And when I started meeting with people at the national labs, I'm like, good grief, why isn't this stuff in a wildlife lab? Why are we testing for one disease instead of a panel? Why aren't we taking the stuff that's negative for H5N1 and seeing what they died of? Why aren't we doing pathogen discovery? We certainly have the technology. We have not applied it to those species that have served as biosentinels, and that's our failure. But it can be corrected. Two time frames. The bottom line is we're talking about two different things, about an event. You know, how do you know something's going on? Versus, how do we sustain this? That's a great question. You know, how is any of this going to keep going year after year after year? Well, zoos are excellent sentinel flocks. They'll still be there. They'll still be doing what they do on a day-to-day basis. And they'll still be trapping all the pest species on their grounds. I guarantee you, I knew probably more than the New York City Department of Health knew how much, you know, the kinds of salmonella we had, the cerevars of leptospirosis, you know, all the pathogens that were in our rodent population because we looked. Something to be said for actively looking for things. I think the key to sustainability is for the federal agencies, local health departments, state health departments to embrace the private sector. We've already shown it can be done. It really isn't rocket science. And we've shown that it works. Our problem is we don't have any, you know, representation. You know, we're private sector. We're not part of a federal agency. We don't have lobbyists in Washington, D.C., demanding our share of the funding. So that's why it hasn't been done. Not because it's not a good idea, though. What I would like to see happen would be to see us, perhaps we can leverage all the funding that's gone into the regional centers of excellence. You've got veterinary diagnostic labs. You have medical universities that have formed these consortiums. Surely, everything we need is right there. Can't we connect those dots and apply some of this, you know, spectacular technology that's being developed for bioterrorism and apply it to day-to-day situations so we can start doing the active disease surveillance that is so necessary but that we still don't do? If we could create real, you know, high-throughput diagnostic, you know, the microarray kind of stuff, and make it cheap enough, because that's the critical point. If you want to do active disease surveillance on wildlife or things that don't have owners, it's going to have to be pretty inexpensive. But I think we can get there. We did with West Nile. We created a test that allowed us to find antigen and cloacal swabs. It can be done. We just have to apply ourselves to that. I asked someone from Lawrence Livermore how much it would cost to put this technology into the National Wildlife Research Lab, National Wildlife Health Center. $300,000 per lab. Don't tell me we don't have that kind of funding. Other things that I think need to be done, and again, this is just my point of view of things that are still left unaddressed but are critical to moving forward in our ability to detect zoonotic threats. Veterinarians don't deal with insurance companies. You know, it's starting, but we do not have to fill out all that paperwork. Because of that, most veterinary practices are not electronic, and because of that, we have no common language. If you want to link the world, you have to start with the medical terminology that'll be acceptable across lines. I know there are three people doing all the bioinformatics work in the United States. They know what needs to be done, but they have not been able to get the funding. National Animal Health Lab Network. Why this is still not fully functional is a mystery to me. The idea was to be able to message all of these labs to the USDA. I met with people at the Google Foundation. I'm hitting up foundations now and begging them to just give us the technology. Lend us some of your engineers and just get it done, for God's sakes. This is not something that's impossible, but it's a question of expertise and manpower. Centralized archives. Well, it was pretty handy having that stuff at the AFIP for the 1918 strain of influenza. But the question is, now that we're dismantling the AFIP, where are those samples going to come from the next go-round? And the fact that we need to look to a different community to maintain those database, those serum banks and things. I'll give you as an example. The West Nile Virus Surveillance Network was probably the single largest disease surveillance effort mounted in the United States for wildlife. It was done by public health. At one of the meetings, CDC stood up and said X percent of the birds were positive, and that meant X percent of the birds tested were negative. And I stood up and said, well, what did the negative ones die of? We don't care. We just wanted to know if they had West Nile. Like, ooh, did you at least bank the samples so people who are interested might be able to test them, like for H5N1? No. The samples were thrown out. That's a major problem. You know, we're reinventing the wheel every day. Some of this stuff you can put on filter paper, it doesn't take a lot of space, and just put it in, you know, in a vault, you know? But throwing it out is really criminal. So, near term, I talked to people again. How much would it cost if we wanted to be able to, with all this West Nile stuff that we're testing, make sure that negative samples are not simply discarded? $400,000, we could set up a nice archive at the National Wildlife Research Laboratory. They're all set up. They can do the archiving. They have the software. Could be done. Longer term, maybe we should be talking to the Smithsonian or the Museum of Southwestern Biology in New Mexico. These are people who know how to maintain archives, maintain samples way into the future. Another thing, this is the buy-in factor. If you want to be able to leverage the day-to-day surveillance that's available in the zoo community, what they would like back is the ability to create a global database. This is a zoo information management system, and it would be used globally. It would leverage the astute diagnosticians and, you know, practitioners in zoos everywhere. So whatever applies to the Bronx also applies to Singapore or Nairobi. Anywhere there's a zoo, the same things that we've benefited by would be available elsewhere. So, West Nile virus, looking at the questions, you know, what were the factors that contributed to delayed recognition of West Nile virus? Well, the fact that we take an agency-based approach versus an agent-based approach. The fact that we continue to have species bias. The fact that we do not apply uniform standards for diagnosticians across species. That hasn't changed. What did we need to get a diagnosis? We needed samples. We needed comparative everything. We needed archives. And most of all, we needed a different mindset, people who are willing to look for something unusual. It's hard to find. And we're left with the question, if this were to happen tomorrow, would anything be significantly different? And until we address the issues I've raised, I'm afraid the answer to that question would probably be no. West Nile virus was indeed a wake-up call for surveillance. Personally, I believe we are heading in the direction, albeit with glacial speed, towards a new kind of biosurveillance. The fact is, the Soviets are way ahead of us in their approach to zoonotic threats. The Tsar Nicholas established the Soviet anti-plague system, and it's in the Soviet Constitution that citizens have a right to be protected from zoonotic outbreaks. They always took an agent-based approach, and they did active disease surveillance. Unfortunately for us, what started out as the anti, you know, something good for public health later morphed into bioterrorism and doing active surveillance for the hottest agent they could find, and then sending it back to Moscow for further characterization. You know, we test for one thing. They tested for whatever was out there. That's a critical difference in our approach. Looking at the budgets, knowing that, you know, there's still going to be an awful lot of money spent in one arena, and that, unfortunately, that means that there may be a lot less money in the public health sector to respond to these threats. If we want to be successful, detect sporadic events, as well as providing sustainable surveillance for those sporadic events, I think public health is going to have to reach out to the private sector and create these creative partnerships. If I were to take a what do we need tomorrow, what do we need down the road, I would say link those three veterinary diagnostic labs that are going to be testing the zoo samples. If we can't fix the National Animal Health Lab network tomorrow, let's at least do this. This shouldn't be too hard. Address the confidentiality issues or really start talking about them, because you're going to have to eventually. What happens if you can't maintain confidentiality? Create the high-throughput diagnostics that will allow us to create baseline and do active surveillance for you. And if someone has any say about, you know, health departments and amending their health code law, please contact New York City Department of Health and they'll give it to you. And the precedent is there. It already exists. There's really no reason other areas shouldn't be doing the same. Sure would be nice in the long run to have public health veterinarians in every state, because at least then, if you were to tell practitioners, this is the 800 number, You see anything unusual, this is a person you call. But today we really don't have that mechanism in many states. Basically, we need to leverage what's out there. You need to maximize the fact that you don't have to pay for all the staffing and stuff. It's already there. It's sustainable. And I think we need to be talking about how some of the biopreparedness funds that are given, that are distributed through HHS down to the state and local health departments, isn't it in everyone's best interest if you put aside a few thousand dollars just to be able to test the stuff that zoos are collecting? Isn't that in your best interest? I think so. So even with completely different mission statements, it doesn't matter. We're not all going to sit around and sing Kumbaya. After 7 years, it's pretty clear to me that's not going to happen. But that's okay. I don't care if you care about wildlife at all. If you care about a diagnosis, we should be looking at some of these things I mentioned very carefully, because they do impact upon public health. The bottom line is, who's to say who or what will, you know, be the bearer of bad news the next go round? And if you're one of those people that shares an ice cream cone with your dog, you know, I hope this brings that issue home, because we really don't know. And these are gaps that we can fix. We just have to be, I think, a little more honest about it and deal with the issues as we did with West Nile virus. Thank you. Yes?
Hi, I'm Jerry Lieberman. I'm with the OGM subcommittee at the Senate Committee on Homeland Security. A lot of this is obviously very convincing, things that some of us have started to read about. But my question is more basic. My understanding is that there is a severe shortage of veterinarians in the United States, ascribed to everything from too few accredited veterinary universities to difficulties in getting into veterinary schools. That seems to be a pretty basic part of what you are proposing here, the ability to have a public health veterinarian in every state. How do you do that with a shortage of veterinarians?
Actually, on Thursday and Friday, I'm going to be at the National Academy of Science on the committee that is on the future workforce needs of veterinary medicine and how do we get where we need to go. It's true that the demographics of veterinary medicine have changed dramatically over the past 20 years, and we simply don't have the people we need to go into food medicine, into public health. I think a lot of it, the other thing we need to recognize is it's very expensive to get a veterinary education. Unfortunately, when they get out into practice, they don't make the kind of money that will allow them to pay off that debt. And that is, I think, plays a major role in why people will or won't be able to go on for advanced training. So I know that Senator Allard has been very active in addressing the workforce shortage and trying to, you know, do something where maybe there's something financially to help the students out so you can encourage that. I think it's going to, you know, I think it will happen because, I mean, the students are all over public health now. They're very interested, and it's a new generation. They have a very different mindset. So, you know, I think we'll get there. There was a question over here. Yes?
My name's Henry Bassman. I'm with Storm Bio. Two questions. They're unrelated, but they're related to your topic. The first question is the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases last week announced six centers of excellence for H5N1 research, three of which were Wildlife Conservation Society out of New York, UC Davis, and University of Alaska Fairbanks. And their primary mission is to observe avian wildlife. So the question is, how is this an advance in terms of your concepts and ideas? And where is this designation that was made? Where is it lacking? What do they need to do more?
Well,
for two springs, I've been following stories about bee die-offs And your talk made me think, is this an advance warning of something else? And is anybody studying what's happening with the bee colonies?
Well, as far as the bees go, actually, you know, with all the pesticide spraying, in some areas it did. It wiped out the honeybee, segment of agriculture. There are people who look at these things, but they have even less money than even within the animal kingdom, it's animals and plants and insects really are lower on the scale, although A, they're great vectors, and B, they can provide early warning. So I don't think that's been addressed from a budget point of view either. I could be wrong. I don't work for the USDA, but that would be the Animal Plant and Health, APHIS groups. And as far as the regional centers of excellence, to my knowledge, the work that's being done is, again, looking at migratory birds. I think that's all well and good. I'm all for enhanced research and, work on wildlife. That's what I did for my career. However, I think we're talking about two different scenarios, an urban setting versus trying to find birds that happen to be flying on a breezeway or a flyway. What zoos have to offer is that they are a stationary population of known individuals that are followed from birth to death, that allow serial sampling, that give you clinical information because they're observed every day. So from an urban public health point of view, I think those animals have a great deal to offer that migratory birds do not, because you don't know where the bird came from. You let it go, it's gone. You can't follow up on migratory birds like you can with a captive population of animals that are, will be there for the duration and can be tracked when they move. So two different things, free-ranging wildlife versus captive wildlife. And I think they both have things to offer to the other. But right now, I think, again, like I said, the emphasis is on finding this stuff in some distant shore. We're still not looking at confiscations, intensively. And I just think there are a lot of things that zoos could help out with on a day-to-day basis. Yes? I think it's a question of time frame. That's the point I was trying to make. I know how weak the wildlife community is and how much effort and money it's going to take to do these international surveillance programs. And given that anything could show up tomorrow, doesn't have to be H5N1. It could just be some new emerging virus right on our shores. My question is, how is it possible that we're 7 years down the road and these issues have still not been addressed? You need to do both, but I know for a fact that the international stuff is going to take a lot longer to do and to set up than it is to simply enhance what already works. Two different things, two different time frames.
Right, but I think the idea, for avian influenza for sure, is that we know that there's a certain ecosystem going on in Asia where we have very close contact between different kinds of hosts, and that hosts are going to be susceptible to this
Yeah.
I do have one question for you.
Okay.
As far without showing symptoms of disease. So is there a possibility to do that kind of
thing? Well, actually, as part of the discussions, we're talking about both active and passive surveillance. Passive surveillance is a sick or dead bird on zoo grounds, you know, waterfowl. Active surveillance is to go out and actually bleed birds every month. So that, you know, from an epidemiological point of view, yes, zoos have agreed to do that. Yes? Well, I know Ian Lipkin, you know, we were involved, you know, co-discovery of the West Nile virus. And shortly after that, and it's just a few months ago, there was news about the green chip. He's at Columbia University at the Green Labs. And, you know, it's a molecular approach. You know, it's he can tell you what's in a sample, even if we don't know what it is. But we haven't been able. We tried to do something back in 2000, 2001, but we have not been able to gain traction. But that's exactly the kind of technology that I think, you know, from a defense point of view, boy, wouldn't that be great to use on the things that are ports? You know, when we don't know, they're pre-symptom, you know, they're asymptomatic or preclinical. Man, I'd love to see us apply that technology to the stuff that's coming across our borders, because as it is, it's sort of, you just sort of eyeball them and, well, they look okay. That's not a very, you know, robust surveillance system. So that's the first thing I would think of. I know the technology is there, but we have not yet been able to get the funding to apply it to these unusual animal communities. And the other thing I'll mention, you know, you could do that because the fact that you're dealing with dogs or cats or zoo animals, you know, they don't impact on trade. You know, it's a problem whenever you get into economics, and let's admit it, sometimes there's a disincentive on the part of agencies to actively look for disease. All right, that's, you know, part of their culture. But you can do some unusual things with these non-agricultural populations, and, you know, that's what we were able to do with West Nile. You know, we were under everyone's radar. That allowed us to set up this unusual network. I think we can do more. Yes?
Yeah, Charles Buck from Kubrick. A comment and a question perhaps blended in. You made allusion to the molecular technologies that are developing, and it strikes me that with the development particularly of these microarray chips where you can put thousands of different nucleotide sequences on it, we're actually finally in the last 5 or 6 years moving to a point where you can imagine a routine panel that would give you some hint as to what's there that you don't already know about.
Right.
That is our standard test. You only find what you look for. The advantage of the isolation techniques is you can find new things, but it's exorbitantly expensive. But here's a middle ground approach where there are so many nucleotides that maybe you don't get a pattern that hybridizes to tell you it's this, but just the fact that you're getting an interesting pattern coming
right
can give you a lead. And I guess the question part is, do you see that actually kind of folding into the sort of...
Yeah, absolutely. Wouldn't that be great if we were using that on animals in shelters? You know, they're a sentinel population. They're out on the streets. They're not in the best of health. You know, they're out there, you know, picking up and spreading disease. and they don't have owners. So, you know, from a, if you want sort of a politically neutral population, let's look at the dogs and cats that end up in shelters and see what's out there. I agree. It can be done, but it hasn't been. And I think some of that is, it has been frustrating in that you mentioned the NIAID stuff and NIH. It's all been they want basic research, basic research. Basic research isn't going to find the emerging pathogen tomorrow. It's going to be enhanced surveillance, and no one seems to want to pay for that. You know, I'm all for doing that kind of technology, but it's not being applied. So where does that leave us? You know, that's my point, really. Yes?
Emily Oberholzer from the Institute for Defense Analyses. I guess my question is how good we are or how good the basic techniques are now for predicting whether a pathogen is going to zoonose into humans. One of the questions that using animals as a surveillance tool, as you predicted, or with the birds in Western Elk case, is that the birds were infected too much before. We really didn't have an indication, a good understanding of, even if we had all that data, of whether it was going to leap into humans. And so I'm curious as to if there's any methods that we're using or trying to identify ways in which, if there's something that we can use, like, okay, this disease is in several different types of species, that we can use as indicators of whether or not it's going to leap into humans.
I don't think we're there yet. I mean, that's the whole field of, you know, the human-animal, you know, interface and emerging pathogens and viruses that are mutating. We'll be lucky if we can just find it fast. I don't think we're anywhere near being able to predict what might, you know, what it might pop up in. Look at all the crazy species that we ended up with West Nile. It was in reptiles. It was in alligators. I mean, it's not supposed to happen that way. So I wouldn't make any guesses on, you know, our ability to be able to do that in the near future. Yeah.
Actually, I don't think I got around to introducing myself with all my remarks. I'm sure I just did here at CSIS. In using captive populations where you go back to the same animal time after time, you lose sensitivity to things they already have sterile converted to. You'll catch the first wave, but mm-hmm. you go back where the strains change or the lifespans are short enough, you get new birds. Is that a problem?
Well, zoos do also get new animals, you know, so it's not just it's not a fixed population. You always have new animals being born, put into the collection, so I think you'd always have a cohort that would be naive to whatever's out there. With West Nile, yeah, I mean, we had a problem where birds seroconverted. Then they're sort of out of your surveillance, you know, program because you couldn't tell. We were also vaccinating. If you're going to vaccinate, as we're discussing, against, you know, West Nile or H5N1, if you want to be able to still use those animals, you're going to need to be able to differentiate between a vaccine titer and a natural exposure. And we haven't begun those studies. Yes. Yeah, I've been, you know, speaking with Jeff and with the other people on that, you know, I gave credit to on that slide, and, you know, been pushing that idea with foundations because we can't seem to get it off the ground. But the bottom line is, since the veterinary community is so primordial with its electronic, you know, capabilities and the tradition of being able to share data across laboratories, what they would like to do, and for $1 million, they would like to establish a center so you have long-term, you know, service. So, because there are going to be so many issues that are going to have to be addressed. And they're working very closely with the public health community as well. So I know it's not sexy, but it is a critical point. You know, you can throw a lot of money at stuff, but unless you do step A, you're not going to get to step B. Yes?
Hi. Joe Buchanan from Johns Hopkins SAIS. A couple comments back, you spoke of port security and migratory birds, but it struck me that these birds don't stop at ports, and clearly we can't stop horizontal transmission between different species. So looking from a biosecurity perspective, other than early detection and rapid response, is there anything else we can really do?
Well, I'll tell you, with our technology, you know, with West Nile virus, this was not my idea, but another person, Dr. Roger Breeze, suggested that, you know, we have those mosquito traps that could be put at every port and at every airport that would not only trap mosquitoes, but how about actually finding out what is in those mosquitoes at the point of entry? And that I'm sure we have the technology to be able to do that. It just hasn't happened. When I'm talking about stuff at ports, I'm talking about things that are smuggled, you know, the illegal pets that end up coming in on a carpet or something. I think that's just an open area for, you know, expansion and a great way to start testing some of this technology. And it would fill a void, because I'm pretty sure we're not doing extensive, you know, workups on any of those animals, because we don't have the financial ability to do so, or the manpower. Is that it? Well, thank you. I didn't bring any cards, but if anyone wants to contact me or if they want a CD of the lecture or anything, because it's too big to email, my email address is D as in David, R, T, McNamara, M-C, N-A-M-A-R-A, at AOL.com.